Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In the 1960s, an insurance magnate named Charles Finley bought the Kansas City A's, and he shipped them over to Oakland, but not before he fitted the team with an all-star roster, including Sal Bando, Reggie Jackson, Catfish Hunter, and Raleigh Fingers, and they were, to say the least, a handful. They went on winning streaks, got into locker room brawls, and as one reporter put it, sported some of the finest mustaches this side of a Burt Reynolds film. Their story captured the heart and mind of one local sports writer, Jason Turbo, and he's written a new book about their hits and misses called Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie, Raleigh, Catfish, and Charlie Finley, Swingin' A's. He's also the author of the best-selling book, The Baseball Codes, The Unwritten Rules of America's Pastime, and has contributed to the New York Times, Wired, and Sports Illustrated. And no, we're not moving into sports talk here, but we thought we would couple a half hour with the great Steve Kerr, with one of our finest sports writers, Jason Turbo, and I said he's got the coolest name of any sports writer around probably as well. And I'm sorry, I didn't even say his first name right here. Jason Turbo, good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Well, let's begin by talking a bit about Charlie Finley, because he looms as such a presence in your book, undisputably. And the reality is, you know, by most standards, he's a pretty terrible man. He did things like, pretty much we know, he was a wife abuser. He assaulted one of your fellow reporters, Jim Steele of the Mercury News. But there are other things about him that parallel someone who's in the White House now. I couldn't help thinking. Have people pointed that out to you? I mean, just a lot of the bullying and a lot of the domination and obsession about numbers and, you know, taking off on people all the time with pique and with impulsivity.
People have pointed that out at every reading I've done, and I couldn't help but think that exact same thing through the entire electoral process. You know, I wrote this book. I started researching it years ago. So I wasn't learning new things about Finley, but boy, I saw a lot of similarities with the guy now in charge.
Yeah, bullying, temper, vindictiveness. There's a lot, and he was an autocratic personality by any standard.
He was. I mean, I think to be fair, he had terrible personality traits, but he also had a lot of genuinely good traits as well, and I think that's what makes him so complex and interesting.
Say the same about our president. He was a great salesman. He was innovative. He was, you know, kind of a promotional genius in some ways, even though a lot of the stuff was way out there. But I suppose the best thing you can say about him, and you do say this about him, is he could be generous sometimes, even though he was such a tightwad and a skinflint.
Yeah, I mean, he really took care of his players in revolutionary ways, most notably, you know, in the days when players earned $20,000 or $30,000 a season, he would invest their money for them, whatever portion of their paycheck they wanted, with the unbeatable guarantee that even if the investments tanked, he would return the entire allotment. And back in those days, that was an unbelievable boon for these guys. He really did take care of them in many ways up until a point, and then their relationship soured and it all went away.
It was because of Charlie Finley, probably, that we had free agency, or to a large degree. Yes.
Yeah, well, he thrived in a system in which he controlled everything, in which he called all the shots. And he was the loudest and almost only voice among ownership ranks saying, do not allow arbitration to happen. And arbitration came around the year before free agency, after the 1974 season.
I mean, he even saw to it what was on the menus and what the organ music was. I mean, it was unbelievable what a micromanager he was.
Absolutely.
And managing the team, in effect, too.
Well, I mean, it reached to the highest levels of the organization. He served as his own general manager. He's the rare owner who couldn't tolerate someone else who might be even more knowledgeable calling the shots. So he just picked up those duties himself, and he was smart enough that he was able to pull it off.
You know, your book gives us a kind of blow-by-blow in every sense of the word. I mean, we go back into the season and all the excitement, different seasons and the World Championship games and so forth in the series. But also, you know, these guys were fighting with one another. There were brawls. There was perpetual tension. It was a colorful team, to put it mildly. And what I came away with was the sense that why hasn't this team gotten, you know, kind of an enduring recognition like the Cubs or the Boston Red Sox in Cooperstown particularly?
Well, that's the key question. I mean, that's what got me thinking about writing this book in the first place, you know, was being in Cooperstown, New York, and being surrounded by memorabilia from the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Cubs, and having to struggle to recognize this team even existed, let alone defined an era. And I think it's all due to Charlie Finley, good and bad. He alienated baseball owners, his colleagues, to such a severe degree that they automatically tuned out almost anything he said. I mean, he made a lot of sense in many ways, and, you know, his ideas were encumbered by the fact they came out of his mouth.
He also alienated players, and we can talk about that. I mean, to a great degree, finally, I mean, they weren't necessarily going to go against him. And you talk about how Reggie Jackson, for example, felt he was going through a police inquisition but signed an apology. And they were trying to be resistant to him, some of them, but a lot of them had to capitulate or felt that, you know, they were in no position to stand firm and rebel against him. But it was really the Mike Andrews case that turn things around, and suddenly he felt the whole team was against him because of that. Talk about that.
Because the whole team was against him.
Right.
Mike Andrews was a second baseman they picked up in the middle of the season in 1973. He had an injured shoulder. He had been released by the White Sox, but he had previously played for the A's manager, Dick Williams. Williams knew that Andrews was no longer a capable fielder. He wanted a right-handed pinch hitter off the bench, and Andrews could do that. Somehow, in Game 2 of the 1973 World Series, in extra innings against the Mets, Andrews found himself in the field, nearly completely unpracticed at the position for months, made a couple of costly errors, and the A's lost the game. Charlie Finley, the owner, was insufficiently grounded in the way a clubhouse runs to realize that that's just part of the game. And his solution was to essentially fire his second baseman. Right, the rosters are locked for the postseason. The only way to have turnover is via an injury. So he concocted an injury for Mike Andrews so he could replace him with minor league second baseman Manny Trio. And he had the team doctor give him a very cursory examination. He strong-armed Andrews into signing a memo based on the doctor's notes. And Andrews went home rather than travel with the team to New York. And as the players flew to New York, they fomented some serious anger. They realized something bad was going on. They had seen the examination. They didn't know all the details yet, but they knew Andrews wasn't with them. And when they landed, the media capital of the world, reporters descended, and the A's players wouldn't stop talking about what a rotten guy their owner was. They went so far as to tape Andrews number 17 on their sleeves in athletic tape for the workout day. And things hit a fever pitch. They talked about boycotting the World Series, of all things. I don't think any of them actually meant it, but they talked openly about it. And it got to the point where baseball commissioner Bowie Kuhn had to step in and order Finley to reinstate Mike Andrews, which Finley grudgingly did, along with his own orders to A's manager Dick Williams to not let Andrews see the field under any circumstances.
Oh, you mentioned the World Series. I can't help thinking about the fact that Dick Williams said, you know, win, draw or lose, I'm leaving. And he was leaving because, regardless of what his rhetoric might have said to the contrary, because of Charlie Finley again. I mean, you have all of these episodes with Charlie Finley, and I think you kind of drive home the point in many ways that it was the animus against Charlie Finley, a lot of the enmity that may have been really a serious driver of this team.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And you know, to put a pin on that last story, Dick Williams did quit.
Yes.
Because of this incident, first he responded to Finley's edict not to let Andrews on the field by sending him up to pinch hit at the earliest opportunity, which was great. The fans in Shea Stadium knew exactly what was going on. They gave him a standing ovation.
But I hadn't heard an ovation like that in a long time.
Not for anybody. Definitely not.
Even Mickey Mantle, maybe.
So Williams in the clubhouse after Game 7, the A's had just won the championship. Champagne was literally in the air. He quit. He called it a career with the A's. He couldn't take it anymore. And I think that's what Finley saw as the biggest insult.
Well, you mentioned, in fact, Finley concocting this injury and Mike Andrews. He concocted a lot of things. He even concocted the name Catfish for Catfish Hunter, which got Catfish Hunter's mother angry because the story was that he ran away from home. And she said, he never ran away from home. You know, this is all Charlie Finley.
Yeah, he loved nicknames, man. And that when Catfish Hunter signed the contract as a teenager out of North Carolina, rural North Carolina, Finley said, there's one more thing. Do you have a nickname? And when Hunter said he didn't, Finley concocted on the spot a story about how Hunter ran away from home and was found with a long string of catfish. And, you know, little Jimmy Hunter had no idea this would last, you know, even into the next day. But, you know, suddenly his career is defined as someone named Catfish. Hunter didn't exist.
Didn't Charlie Finley also, if memory serves me, which it doesn't as well as years go by, but didn't he also say offer some money to Vita Blue if you change his name to True, became True Blue?
He did. The problem with that theory was that Vita Blue is actually Vita Blue Jr. His father had died only a few years earlier, and Vita was exceptionally proud of his name, and he turned Finley down. Finley was so persistent that the A's eventually drafted a guy named Bill Daniels, a pitcher, nicknamed Sugar Bear. And Vita wouldn't even pose for pictures with him until the photographers promised him that Sugar Bear would be found nowhere in the captions, just Bill Daniels.
talking, if you've just joined us, with Jason Turbo, sports writer, author of Dynamic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie Raleigh, Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's, and he's the author also of The Baseball Codes. He'll be speaking at Rakestraw Books in Danville on the 18th of April in the Oakland Library's Temescal branch on April 22nd, and at the Lafayette Library on May 25th. And you can speak with him now. If you have memories of those 70s A's, or if you have questions about them, Charlie Finley, a figure larger than life, makes me think of Shelley's Ozymandias. You know, if you know that poem, it's about the great ruler and so forth. And now just there's the sands and everything's kind of defaced and eroded and so forth. We just have these memories, which Jason has brought back alive, of Charlie Finley. Let me invite you to join the program. You can do that a number of ways. You can join us by calling our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your involvement. Questions or comments about the A's of the 70s, again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We welcome your involvement in the program, and please feel free to be part of the program. Now, I was really touched by some of the stories you tell, Jason. I mean, I remember some of them. Some of them I had to jog this memory that, as I said, is starting to go a bit. But you talked about wearing number 17, for example. Also, when the Munich massacre took place, Ken Holtzman and Mike Epstein, who were both Jewish, wore black armbands, and so did Reggie Jackson.
That's true. They were beside themselves, Epstein and Holtzman, the night it happened. They weren't sure it was an isolated incident. They didn't know if athletes in general were at risk. And Epstein had been an Olympian, so he was really feeling it very deeply. They ended up walking the streets of Chicago, where the team was playing, just the two of them at night, trying to make sense of something that could make no sense. Their solution, as best there was one, was to ask the team equipment manager to put black armbands on their uniforms. When they showed up the next day, there they were, and so was a black armband on the sleeve of Reggie Jackson. And in my process of interviewing these guys, this was probably the starkest example of how divisive Reggie was in terms of perception among his teammates. Mike Epstein was livid that he was homing in on this event that was very meaningful to the two Jews on the team because it would bring him more spotlight. You know, he was an attention hog, and Epstein didn't like it. I talked to Holtzman separately, and Holtzman said, you know what? Reggie grew up in a largely Jewish neighborhood in Wincote, Pennsylvania, and he knew Jews. He understood the Jewish experience in ways that most of his teammates didn't, and that he was a lot deeper than people give him credit for. And Holtzman was fully on board.
Yeah, but he had a fight with Epstein, too, yeah. Over saying there were some tickets and they were playing the Rangers, I guess. They talk about there are no Jews in Texas or some kind of throwaway line like that.
And, yes.
I mean, there were so many guys who came to blows here. In fact, I think it was Raleigh Fingers who said when Reggie was fighting with Billy North, again, superstar, you know, they would taunt him with that. He says, you know, it's like watching the Ollie Frazier fight just in the locker room. But you had a fight, actually, Raleigh Fingers. Somebody made a remark, what was it, Odom, in fact.
Blue Moon Odom.
Who said something about, you know, his wife. They were going through a divorce and so forth. These guys, I mean, but still they managed to play like a team, and they did play like a team, a great team.
Yeah, that fight happened the day before the 1974 World Series. The timing mattered not. But really, I think that was the secret sauce. These guys held each other accountable verbally in ways that I've never seen in you know, my decades as a sports writer. You know, if you exhibited bad behavior or made a lazy play on the field, you wouldn't hear about it from one or two guys. You'd hear about it from every corner of the clubhouse. And that accountability kept them consistently excellent. But they pushed the boundaries so far that they frequently crossed them. And then egos would get bruised and fists would start flying. I think it was all part and parcel of their success.
It's funny that you talk about secret sauce, because Mayor Libby Schaaf has said, you know, Oakland, we have our secret sauce. She's used that metaphor a couple of times. And I didn't get to ask Steve Kerr about the Warriors leaving Oakland, but it's going to make a big difference where the A's are concerned. In fact, they're already promoting the A's, realizing that they're losing the Warriors.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, non sequitur to this book, but I wrote a story for San Francisco Magazine a couple of years back when the Warriors first announced their move, and all I did was talk to Warriors fans. And boy, they were devastated then. I can only imagine how serious it'll be once that becomes real.
Join us again if you would care to, and we do invite you to do that with our guest, Jason Turbo, who's here with us in studio. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And we've got a caller from Ohio. George, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I've been loving the show. I was in 1967. I just graduated from high school. We moved from South Carolina to the Washington, D.C. area. And we used to go watch Senators game at the old D.C. stadium. And we went to a game where they played the Oakland A's. And one of their coaches at the time was Joe DiMaggio, okay, one of the A's coaches. And, you know, I guess he was pretty famous for not signing autographs. But after the game was over, the team bus was sitting out in front of the stadium. And DiMaggio was sitting in the window seat with it down. And I went up and I asked him, I said, Joe, can you please sign your autograph here? And he took the program, he signed his autograph, and then he passed it back, and a bunch of the other players signed it, including one who was sitting on the very back seat, and he signed it, Slugger Jackson. I guess we know who that was.
Slugger Jackson. Yeah, that was a coup for Finley to get DiMaggio on the staff. It happened as soon as the A's moved here in 1968. Finley promised him a VP job, but then failed to assign him a desk or any actual VP work. So DiMaggio ended up as a de facto coach. And it worked out for him because he needed two more years of active duty to qualify for his maximum MLB pension. So this was a perfect way for him. He was a Bay Area resident. It kind of worked out for everybody.
And let me thank thanks for the call, George. Good to hear from you. Here's speaking about Slugger Jackson. Mark writes, Reggie Jackson said that if it were not for free agency, the A's teams of the early 70s, quote, never would have lost, by which he presumably meant that as long as the nucleus of the team stayed healthy and did not get too old, the team could have probably won two or three even more World Series titles. Here's the insights, thoughts.
No question about that. I mean, at the time they broke up, Finley broke them up because of free agency. He knew that he wouldn't be able to sign them. He had no interest in playing under the new financial arrangement wherein the players would have a huge say in their own futures. He didn't work that way. It had to be Finley in charge. These guys were almost to a man 26, 27, 28 years old. They were just entering their primes. And if they had been locked up for another 5 years, I don't doubt that they would have won another 2, 3, 4 championships. And it's worth noting that across the country, a guy who played by the same rules that Charlie Finley eschewed, George Steinbrenner, won back-to-back championships with Charlie Finley's two best players, Slugger Jackson and Catfish Hunter.
Yeah, there's one moment in your book where you say perhaps the only time in his life that we know of that Charlie Finley was actually speechless after the Reds won and Dave Duncan said something. You want to talk about that?
Well, yeah, the A's had just beat the Reds in the 1972 World Series, and you know Finley was giddy. He still had a reasonable relationship with many of his players at that point. Dave Duncan had it in for Finley since really he had signed a contract as a 17-year-old. He had wanted outside help dealing with the contract. Finley refused it. He said, you got to sign it yourself or I'm going to take it away and it'll never appear again. Duncan signed it. He found out later that numerous teams had been authorized to go well above what Finley had offered. So Finley sat down in the seat next to him on the airplane, tried some good natured banter. And essentially Duncan said, heck, Charlie, you don't care about what I have to say. You don't care about any of us. You treat us like things and not like people. And Finley had no idea how to respond to that. And he kind of staggered off. Duncan's response was, I'd like to drop this whole thing on Bad Breath, Montana. Not that I have anything against the good people there.
Let me bring another caller aboard here, and we go to a caller in Virginia. James, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for the show. I was a kid growing up in the Bay Area, born in 65. So, you know, my family loved baseball, especially my mom. We used to go to a lot of A's games. I tell everybody my story. When we beat the Dodgers in the World Series in the early 70s, my family was there at, I think it was Game 6, and some people might remember the fans got to storm the field in celebration. And you
it's
know,
all in Jason's book.
Well,
yeah, it's all. I'm sorry, go ahead with your memory, please.
I was just going to tell you that I pulled up part of the third baseline and took it home and planted it in my backyard. Growing up as a kid, we didn't know Charles Finley, but we loved the Oakland A's, and those were great times.
They were. I'll tell you, storming the field was much more of a thing then. Darryl Knowles was called into the final game of that series. He didn't have his cap because someone had prematurely stormed the field, yanked it off his head, and disappeared into the crowd. He had to take Catfish Hunter's cap, which was half a size too small. He just kind of pulled it down. And then after the game, someone stole that cap off his head.
You were a little young when all this was going on, too.
Yeah, I was but a wee toddler.
You were a boy, but not necessarily having, well, the maturity you have now. You had to go back and really discover it again.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, literally discover it for the first time. Dave is next. Dave, you're on.
Yeah, I thought I'd be the guy asking about salaries, and I'd welcome your thoughts on the continued escalation of sports salaries. And I actually say with some hesitation because I'm very happy for the sport, for all the athletes to get as much money as they can. But, you know, when you think of them in relation to models for kids, for, you know, runaway capitalism, et cetera, but I just welcome your thoughts on that, on salaries in relation to sports in general.
Well, it's what the market will bear, right? I mean, baseball has never been healthier. Spending a lot of time researching the early 70s, so many of the teams, the vast majority of teams, especially in the American League, didn't draw a million fans in a season. Attendance was paltry compared to what it is now. The owners are making more money than ever. Their teams are more valuable than ever. The players are making more money than ever. And ultimately, the people who lose are the fact, you know, the fans, that you have to pay $20 for the cheapest seat in the house. I mean, I remember the days when you could go into Candlestick and see a game for just a couple bucks. Those are long gone.
Let me thank the caller. And one of the big stories that certainly takes a good deal of attention in your book is Vita Blue's holdout in 1972. And that, I think people, and I do remember, I mean, it was so dramatic at the time. It was big news.
Well, Vita had an agent, which in baseball was fairly unheard of, and certainly in Charlie Finley's baseball organization, it was unheard of. Finley contemptuously referred to the guy as Vita's notary. But this was an essential facet of Charlie Finley, is he wanted to be right about everything all the time, and he didn't care the cost. So Vita had a 1971 season for the record books. He won the American League Cy Young Award and the American League MVP Award, becoming the youngest man to win either, let alone both at the same time. He was 21 years old. The craziest stat to me is that one out of every 12 tickets sold in the American League in 1971 was to see Vita Blue pitch. He packed ballparks everywhere. He wanted a taste. Finley made a very reasonable offer, bumping Vita's salary from $14,500 up to $50,000. It would have been the highest salary ever at the time for a second-year player. Vita wanted more, also reasonably so. But Finley felt he'd been fair and he wasn't going to budge under any circumstances. It didn't matter that he was costing his team in the field the services of its best pitcher. It didn't matter that one gate of Vita Blue pitching in the Coliseum would have more than recouped his entire contract demand. And then it's all bonus for Finley. He wanted to be right.
He was stubborn about, you know, having to be right. In fact, let's fast forward a bit, because at one time he decided to fine Vita, and Vita brought in all nickels.
That was actually Alvin Dark who fined him, but yeah.
I was Alvin Dark, that's right, yeah. I was thinking it was Charlie Finley. Alvin Dark, who always had his Bible handy. I mean, that story is also kind of a fascinating one to follow after Dick Williams left and Dark became the manager. But you got so much of this team down here and the spirit of it. You know, it's amazing to realize that you were just kind of a toddler when all this was going on.
Yeah, well, I mean, I lived in the 1971 Oakland Tribune, in 1971, all the entire 70s. I read every issue from 71 through 76 and got very steeped, and I was lucky that the Tribune's beat writer at the time, Ron Bergman, was so excellent at his job. It became a joy to do.
Well, we're talking about analogies to Trump. The other thing is that Finley had ongoing wars with the media, with the sports writers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He never really understood that if you're going to win the public, you got to win the media, and he treated the media like garbage. He wanted all the attention, and when reporters tried to do feature stories on Reggie Jackson, he wouldn't let them on the plane. Even though the rest of the reporters were on the plane, he refused press passes for guys trying to do feature stories for big magazines because he wanted the attention for himself. There's a story in the book about how he promised the media members at the World Series lobster for the first 50 media members who showed up in the dining room. But no matter how early they showed up, the lobster was always all gone because Finley fed it to his friends and family first. And which is his own prerogative. That doesn't matter. His problem was that he set expectations while having no intention of fulfilling them. And that created enemies. He didn't get press because he really didn't deserve it the way he treated the media.
We also probably lost Catfish Hunter to a great extent because of a stubbornness of there was a deal, and it's, we don't necessarily get in the weeds here, but there was a very detailed deal about paying Catfish Hunter a certain amount of money, but he wanted Catfish to pay the taxes basically on that money, and Catfish Hunter said no, and that was really much reason why he walked and wound up with the Yankees.
Yeah, contractually, Finley was obliged to pay half his salary into an insurance annuity for which he himself would be responsible for the taxes. He tried to back out of it, and it was eventually ruled that you know, over his refusal to pay $25,000 in taxes, Catfish would be really baseball's first true free agent, and Finley lost, you know, the mainstay of his pitching staff.
Let me bring another caller on. That's you, Mike. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Those A's teams were so entertaining to watch, and I remember the importance of base running to those teams, and the ability to which they took extra bases and stole bases. But to me, the straw that stirred the drink was Campanaris, and as a leadoff hitter, I don't think he ever got a fraction of the credit that he deserved, and I'll take your comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. Jason?
Yeah, I think you're right. Campanaris was a fantastic leadoff hitter, really a self-made guy. He came from Cuba with virtually nothing. He signed for $500 and a plane ticket to the U.S., turned into one of the best leadoff guys in the game. I think your point about base running acumen really goes to Dick Williams, though. He's the guy who took a talented bunch of players and drilled them incessantly on the mechanics of the game to the point where they knew what to do instinctively and could succeed.
And Finley also brought in a great runner at one point, you know, and paid to bring him in. He didn't have a whole lot of skills when it came to baseball. He was just a very fast guy.
You're talking about Herb Washington,
yeah,
who was a world champion sprinter out of Michigan State. Hadn't played baseball since his sophomore year of high school. Had very little idea what to do on the ball field, but boy, could that guy run. Finley loved what he called rabbits, guys who could scamper around the bases. He figured that Herb Washington could pick up the necessary baseball skills. He did to a degree, but it never really worked out. Not to mention that, you know, the rest of the A's didn't like being pulled for half a ball player.
Well, congratulations again on really an exciting, fun book. I appreciate your spending this time with us. The book, again, is Dynamic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie, Raleigh, Catfish, and Charlie Finley, Swingin' A's. And the author, Jason Turbo, will be speaking at Rakes Raw Books in Danville on the 18th of April, the Oakland Library's Temescal Branch on the 22nd of April, Lafayette Library on May 25th. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And when we return in our second hour, we're going to talk about politics and do the roundup we often do in the first hour. So stay tuned for that. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.